You're listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, grassroots, community, solar-powered, absolutely wonderful original radio.
Absolutely.
Broadcast from the Cultural District here in Fairfield, Iowa. This is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline for the first time in, what, about 5 months?
We're together again.
Ooh, on
we're
the
back.
We're back.
Good for you.
Yeah, it was.
So I am Monica Hadley, and Caroline is my co-host and mother, and the old hand at the radio. When did you start on the radio, Mom?
Let's see, 73, I think. Wasn't
get
it?
Down, yeah.
Didn't we move in? We moved here in 72. I started
so almost
the next
40. That's 40 years.
Yeah. Then I had
a little bit of a break
when I was teaching school.
Where?
Here in town. Mm-hmm. I taught at junior high and the high school.
Oh.
After Monica's father died, I had to support myself. So I had to go back and get my teaching certificate and did that for a while. Then married a man from Mount Pleasant, moved over there, and. Then started at radio in Burlington on the Christian radio station there for a while. And then Monica started this, and so I'm back.
And, of course, Caroline was born and raised in Iowa, lived in eastern Pennsylvania, northern California, and made her way back to Iowa.
Yes.
And our guest has a little bit of a similar story, except he went even a little further afield.
Oh, much further afield, yes.
So with us today is Norman Zierold, author of That Reminds Me, A Conversational Memoir. That's his most recent book. He's also the author of Garbo, biographies including Garbo, The Child Stars, The Moguls, Little Charlie Ross, and Three Sisters in Black, which are true crime accounts, those last two. Three Sisters in Black garnered a special Edgar Allan Poe Award from the Mystery Writers of America.
Wow.
And I know there's even more that we'll talk about here soon. And Norman has been living here in Fairfield for a number of years, and he is... he works in the communications office at Maharshi University of Management. At the, are we allowed to say your age?
At a fine age.
At a fine age. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Norman.
Thank you.
How long have you been living in Fairfield?
In and out for about 30 or 40 years, but out as much as in. I arrived, around...
Same time we did.
during the Punic Wars, I believe. Yeah, about the same time you did.
Yeah.
But the last 10 years I've been here working in public relations here.
Now, Norman, you grew up in the Amana colonies, which is a very unique part of Iowa. Mm-hmm. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it's such a beautiful place. It's southeast Iowa, not far, too far from here. And when I grew up, it was really country. Mm-hmm. Now it's a very, very popular tourist haven. About 50,000 tourists a week have been going there until the sort of kind of recession that set in. Then it slowed down a little bit. But when I grew up, there were just, in the little town that I was in, there were only 5 houses. Imagine, way up on a hillside, and if I looked out the back window, there was a field with the cattle grazing, and it was just so rural and beautiful and calm, and streams running through, a river running through the Iowa River, and forest areas. And I worked on the farms a couple of summers, and those were among the highlights of my life. It's just marvelous to work, you know, working with the earth. And
now, your family were not farmers?
Well, my family ran a restaurant and a hotel for the community, which belonged to the community. And so I grew up helping in every area there. I'd help in the mornings. I'd see that the ladies were shelling peas or something like that. And when I was 7 or 8 years old, I would just sit down and start shelling peas because that's what one did, you know. And so we just always had a wonderful time. And then as the years went on, I was old enough to sort of wait on tables. And I just loved that. It was just marvelous. Dancing around that dining room, you know. And you wouldn't believe what life was like in those days. A full scale meal with all the meats, the chicken or the steak and so on and so forth, all locally grown, all the vegetables grown in the garden mm-hmm. by our family. And you know what a meal would cost? 50 cents.
Oh, my word.
Five or six courses, you know, homemade apple fritters and stuff like that. Everything that you want, and as much as you could eat. And people would come and say, they'd say, how much is it? And you'd say, 50 cents. And they'd say, their eyes would fall, because this was the Depression, 1930s. And they'd say, do you have any sandwiches? And just broke your heart to realize that these people didn't have 50 cents to buy a meal. But then gradually the country became somewhat more affluent, and the farmers, who suffered with everyone else, they suddenly became much better off.
Now, when you say that the hotel and restaurant was owned by the community,
mm-hmm.
do you want to explain what that means? Because I don't know if everyone understands
what the Amanas are. Right.
Yeah.
The Amanas are a spiritual community, basically. They were founded around in 1714 by two men named Rockengruber in Germany, in a small duchy called Ronneberg, and there's still a restaurant in the town that's called the Ronneberg Inn. Good food, by the way. And they left Europe because they didn't want to get involved in all those little wars between the little different countries. There was always something going on, and everyone was being persecuted for this and for that, and they just wanted to have their own belief in God and so on and so forth. I'd say it was a sort of offspring of the Lutheran mentality, I'd say. And they traveled first to New York, outside of Buffalo, to a little community called Ebenezer, but it existed at its best when it was in isolation. And when the town of Buffalo crowded in, off they moved across the country in their horse and buggies and came to Iowa. And they were on a bluff overlooking where the Amanas now are. And they said it reminded them of the Bible, a certain passage in the Bible overlooking a valley. And that's where the word Amana, I think, came from, which means now, remain true.
Is it related to Amish at all?
No, that's interesting, because it somehow it's logically...
You would think so,
yes. I don't know why exactly, but there were all these little communities around during that period in the whole country, by the way. There were the Amish, and there were the Mennonites,
mm-hmm.
and so on and so forth. But the Amish have no modern conveniences at all. They just they've kept their ways. They still wear their dark clothing, and they drive a horse and buggy. So they're different. And they come, by the way, they're very, very good workers, and the Amanas hire them all the time to do this and that. And the Mennonites, I'll tell you an interesting story. Later on, I...
I knew he would.
That
reminds me, and that's what Norman's book is like. It's one interesting story
after another.
Well, not in any particular order, but just what occurs to you as you go through.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
That's
and
how
so
I wrote it.
We'll talk a little more about that
process
after you tell us the story.
Yeah, tell us the story.
What was I? What were we?
The Mennonites.
Oh, the Mennonites. When I later on, I went to Harvard on the GI Bill, with the GI Bill of benefits, which you may know nothing about nowadays. But veterans who had served more than a year could go to any school that they qualified for, and I qualified for about. Tried four of them. They all accepted me.
That was a great program.
Oh. It helped so many servicemen. Yeah. I hope they're doing something worthy like that now. In any event, I went to Harvard, and after the first quarter or semester, I was called into the dean's office, and I thought, oh, dear, what have I done? You know, what have I been called in? And here was the dean of men, very nice gentleman, and he said, how are you? And I said, just wonderful, but I do worry about what you're going to tell me. He said, well, stop worrying, he said. I remember when your application came across my desk. I am a Mennonite from the Iowa City area. And when I saw an application come in from an Amana boy, I said, we ought to have the fella here at Harvard.
Oh.
Can you imagine?
Oh, gosh.
I mean, talk about good luck.
Yeah.
Connection.
Yeah.
Connection.
Yep.
Well, my father's family were Mennonite.
Is that right?
Up until my grandfather's became Presbyterian, I think. But mm-hmm. but his family, his parents and so forth were Mennonite. He had something like 11 or 12 brothers or sisters in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania.
Oh, yeah.
And if you go back 11 generations from him was Hans Herr, who came from Germany and founded the Mennonite community.
Oh.
My maiden name was Herr.
Herr.
Yeah.
Double
so,
R.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Founded the Mennonite community in Lancaster County, received a land grant from William Penn.
My goodness.
To found that. And
there you go now. You remind me again of something that I wrote. William Penn, you said.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote quite a number of books on Hollywood, and then I sort of talked to a friend of mine named Marguerite Young, who was a wonderful novelist in her prime at that time. And I always asked her about whether I should go ahead with certain ideas. And I was working at Theater Arts magazine at the time, and I would always ask her, I've got this idea for a book, and she'd say, what is it? And then she'd say, no, stay where you are. You're doing very well. You're getting a nice job. And finally, I mentioned to her that I was going to write a book about unsolved mysteries, crime mysteries. And she said, write a book about little Charlie Ross. Little Charlie Ross was a little four-year-old boy. And this was 1874, 2 years away from 1876, which would, of course, be 100 years before the founding, you know, Declaration of Independence. And this, everyone in Philadelphia was preparing a big, big, big celebration for that 100th anniversary of American independence when a little boy of four named Charlie Ross was kidnapped. And there had never been a kidnapping for ransom before, and there was a demand for ransom.
Wow.
And so I wrote this book, which was a very, very touching and almost beautiful story because of the, you know, the love of the parents for their children. They had a whole big family, but the one that was missing was the one that their hearts were with. So I wrote this book, which is a very touching and beautiful story. And it was reviewed, you know, in the New York Times and places like that. And it was just delightful too. So that reminded me of that story.
Now, was that the first book that you published?
No, the first was The Child Stars. Mm-hmm. But before I leave a little Charlie, when I published that, I was told that I had a big interview coming up, like the one with you here. You know who it was with?
Barbara Walters.
Yes, yeah. It was with Barbara Walters.
Wow.
Oh, of course, you read the book.
You were here.
So then I went to see Barbara, and this is kind of, should I just tell that story?
Yes, please do.
Because it was it's one of my fondest memories. Because I went to the studio where the Today Show was being filmed at that time, early in the morning, 5:30, I think it was. I think it was at least that early. And Barbara asked me, she said, we had a few minutes before, and she asked me, what she did was she handed me a sheet of paper, and she said, Norman, I haven't had time to read your book. We'll have to wing it. Here are the questions that the staff prepared for me. Look at them while I do a commercial. So I looked at these questions about my book and so on and so forth. And then she came on. She said, well, what do you think, Norman? And I said, Barbara, the questions are rather boring. And she just ripped them into shreds and said, I thought so. She said, what do you want me to ask you? And we'll have to wing it. And she was just so in command and so pleasant. And I said, just ask, how did you come to write this book? And which is what we were just talking about.
Yep.
And that worked out fine. And, oops. Here, this is a chair I'm not used to. So then we had a very, very pleasant session, and she asked me, you know, when you ask, start a question like that, it starts a whole
conversation.
Right. So we had a wonderful conversation, and she talked. We talked mostly about my first book. Mm. You just asked me about my first book.
Right.
And that well, my first book was called The Child Stars, and her husband, of an earlier time in her life, was a producer who had taken Judy Garland, produced her one of her farewell tours.
And was it the one that you saw her on?
It could have been. It could have been. Because, and we can talk about that at some point if
yes.
you want.
Yeah.
But she told me that she thought that Judy, you know, Judy always talked about her mother having taught her to use amphetamines to keep lively and downers to go to sleep and so on and so forth. I mean, it was a studio and her mother. And Judy often blamed them both, but she blamed her mother. And Barbara was very interesting. She said, you know, Norman, I think that we have to eventually forgive our parents, our mothers, our fathers, and anyone else. You have, you know, after 30 or 40, you have to sort of come to peace with things. You have to let go. And that meant a lot to me. I thought, God, that lady knows what she's talking about. Well, and I think that's why she's so successful.
At that age, you're on your own, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah. And what I realized more and more as the years went on was how much good I took from my mother and father. Mm. They were never greedy. They, you know, at the dinner table, they wouldn't eat three times as much as someone else, and then there wasn't enough left, like I do sometimes. No, but my own feelings in that area, to be moderate, come from them, because mm-hmm. they were just wonderful and sweet like that. My mother, for example, used to crochet little, what do you call them, thumb things, to when you're sewing, you put on your thumbs.
Thimble.
Thimble.
Yeah.
And she'd sell them in our little hotel restaurant for $2. And I'd say, Mom, you could get five easily. And she said, I'm just satisfied with two. And that put me, you know, put me in my place. That was just right. But I wrote The Child Stars. That Judy talked about a great deal, and so that was my first book.
Wasn't there a producer that for the Wizard of Oz wanted to make her a blonde with
curly hair, long locks? Yeah,
and then
Mervyn LeRoy. Yeah,
and then somebody else said, "No, she's going to be that, in that," and what she was perfect.
Yeah, in the Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that was Mervyn LeRoy produced that, and for the book. The Child Stars, I interviewed him at his beautiful palatial home in Beverly Hills. And the Wizard of Oz, briefly, a producer named George Cukor, C-U-K-O-R, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Was the producer on that at the beginning. For some reason, he exited at a little, fairly early in the game. But he saw that they had Judy wearing these long locks as a blonde and so on and so forth, and he got rid of all that and got her to be just plain, simple. That was part of the success of The Wizard of Oz, that it had this beautiful simplicity to it. It
mm-hmm.
was
a fairy
tale with wonderful people in it. The Wizard of Oz.
Indeed. The other antidote you have in there is about Marilyn Monroe when she was walking with Truman Capote on the street, and yes, nobody was paying attention, and he said something to her, and she said, "Oh, you want me to be her?"
Yeah.
And then she changed her, you know, persona, and everybody's, "Oh, that's Marilyn Monroe."
That's exactly the way it happened. Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it, that everyone thinks that these people are, you know, we have this glorified idea, but when Marilyn was just relaxed and being with a friend, Truman, walking down Fifth Avenue, everyone else was just walking along. They didn't think much about it. But then when Truman said, when Truman told her that, he said, "No one's paying any attention to us, Marilyn." And she said, "Oh, you want me to be her?" And she, you know.
So she could turn it on.
She could just turn it on.
And turn it off.
And Garbo was like that. There's the famous story of she was in an elevator. I think Groucho Marx came in and said, didn't you used to be Greta Garbo?
Now, you had a personal contact with Garbo as well as writing.
Interesting thing is the producer, the man who, Saul Stein, it was Stein and Day who published that book, and Garbo was known to be litigious. In other words, she liked to go to get lawyers, to sue people, yeah, from talking about her in a way that she didn't like, you know. And so we had to work on that in that case.
So you never interviewed her directly?
No, I was told not to, but I interviewed many, many of her friends. And by the way, she had asked her friends not to give interviews about her. But these people did. And then later, and a little bit later, I became a close friend of Jessica Dragonette, who was a songbird. She sang beautifully and was a big radio star. But she was a close friend, and her sister, Nadia Loftus Dragonette, they were both very close friends of Garbo, and they told me that she had just loved the book Garbo.
Oh.
So, and about a good section of it was serialized in McCall's magazine. So I made a nice little bundle on that. Mm-hmm. And I was awfully glad that she liked it. Made me feel good.
It seems like celebrity biographers now, I'm thinking of that Kitty something woman.
Kitty Kelly.
Yeah, that they want to go for the
jugular.
Yeah, and for the dirt.
Yeah.
They're trying to dig up the dirt. Was it different when you were
Well, you know, I'm very glad you asked that, because when you start writing about yourself, you're forced to write about a lot of other people. And so that question comes up again and again. Well, do I really want to say that about someone?
Oh, yeah.
About myself or about someone else? So you're censoring yourself all the time.
Yeah.
But you have to let some of this out, because as Henry Fonda said when someone was writing his book, he said, "Tell it all, warts and all,"
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But when they're your own warts, you think twice about it. With other people, you also think about it. But it's a constant consideration. And I just didn't feel like making a great splash with something that would perhaps hurt someone, and so I sheltered them to that degree. But I don't think that I portrayed them wrongly. You know, I portrayed them accurately. I just didn't. The
Did
fact
you leave things out?
Yeah.
Now, in your memoir, obviously you have that. But when you're writing a biography of somebody,
well, you know, it's if they're dead, and most of their friends are dead, I think you have a right then to say whatever you want to.
Right.
I think while they're still around, you have to have a certain amount of, you know, I knew that Garbo was just determined to have her privacy. And I felt that to tell about the romances that she had with various people, perhaps male and female, if she acknowledged them, then I saw no reason not to mention them. But I didn't feel as though it was my job to unearth something that she may not have wanted to mention. Who knows?
Yeah.
Well, we all have things we've done we're not proud of.
Yeah.
And we all have warts.
Or yeah. It may not be that you're not proud of it. It's just you don't want other people to know.
That's right.
That's right. That's true.
Yeah, yeah. I think sometimes you'll say something to a close friend that you wouldn't want particularly to
get out.
To get out, yeah.
So I read once where you should never put anything on paper that you wouldn't want read in open court.
Ooh. Well, you know, that's why publishers actually have lawyers to read manuscripts and say, you'd better not say this.
Oh, really?
Because we can... Oh, yeah. There's a phrase for that, and... It's not nowadays you can say most anything, you know.
Yeah,
it's just
right. True
that the times have changed.
Yeah,
but in the time that I was writing, that was after all 40 or 50 years ago for some of these books, and there was much more privacy. I mean, the Kennedys we now know had very lively
yes
lively amorous escapades, but the press always shielded them, never said a word.
You know, that
about
was always
them.
Interesting to me that they did that, though.
Yeah,
it really was.
Yeah,
yeah.
But they did that not just for the Kennedy, they did that
for everyone.
Yeah,
Roosevelt, FDR,
yeah,
and probably everyone, probably every major political figure between him and... When did it start to change? I mean, certainly by Clinton it was completely different.
Well, he broke new ground.
True.
And I think I liked him a lot, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
He was colorful, you know.
Definitely.
He just definitely let the... He kept us amused. Still doing so.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Norman Zierold, author of That Reminds Me, a conversational memoir, which is being released on Amazon on January 12th, which if you're listening to us live, today's Friday, January 11th. If you're listening to our rebroadcast, it's January 14th, 2013. So you have the opportunity to go to Amazon, order this book. Is it available both as print and electronic? It will be. At the moment, it's just print. And with a really nice cover. Who did your cover design? Ken, do you want to... We also have Ken Chalkins, who plays quite a role in this book happening, I believe.
Absolutely. He put it together with all these wonderful people's help. And so if he gives you a few names here, it'll be wonderful.
Okay.
Yes, we're so fortunate to be here in Fairfield, where there are a lot of creative, dynamic people in this town. Very generous people as well. And so I approached Alan Cobb. I think you know him in the community. And
yes.
He has his own publishing company, and he also does the layout design for the book inside. So he gave us a very generous fee. And for us, and he was worked above and beyond whatever that fee was. And in fact, right now as we're speaking, he's in the middle of turning it into an ebook for Kindle.
Mm.
And so we've gone through many refinements. And then the cover is George Foster covers. George is a dear friend.
And both of these gentlemen are previous Writers' Voices guests. You can check out their interviews on our archives at KRUUFM.com.
Well, you know, Norman and I work in the media team under Bob Roth, and Bobby and I have been needling Norman for many years to write down his stories because they're so fascinating. And so finally He did. And, you know, he sent it off to his original publisher and agent.
I burst into print.
Again.
Again. Yeah.
And basically, Bobby and I said, let's just do this for Norman. So that's what we did. And we gave him 100 copies. We're planning to do a book signing in Revelations. We haven't set a date yet. And we're also hoping that someone will write a nice interview or a review for The Source. Monica, if you're interested. And, you know, everything is still in motion. But the big hurdle was to get this finally in print and also now digitally. And Norman, between ourselves, we really have some interesting connections from this town and also in New York and L.A. And the plan is to sort of get copies in the hands of those friends and to see what will happen. In fact, we're planning to get one to Barbara Walters. And as it turns out, her agent, Norman, tell that story.
Oh, right. Well, her agent is, let me see, Lynn Nesbitt. I just found that when I checked to see what Barbara's address was listed on the internet, and it mentioned that Lynn Nesbitt was taking care of her publicity. Well, the first book I wrote was The Child Stars, and I should really tell you how the first. This is kind of interesting. How does a first book come about?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Well, I had been working on a magazine, Theater Arts Magazine in New York, and that's a very interesting story, too. It was the leading theater magazine going, and when that was finished, when it changed hands and everybody was let go and some new people came in, I decided to do what I'd always thought I might do, write a book. But what should I write about? So month after month, I would go to my friend, the novelist Marguerite Young, and say, Marguerite, I've got this idea for a book. And she'd say, what is it? And I'd say, and she'd say, no. You stay at what you're doing, editing some nice magazine and working like that and having nice lunches with me. I'd pay for them, too. So this went on for a couple of years, actually. And then one day I said, Marguerite, I'm going to write a book. And she looked dismayed and said, what about? And I said, The Child Stars, Mickey Rooney, Judy Garland, Freddie Bartholomew, Deanna Durbin, and so on, you know, Judy, and all the others. And without a moment's hesitation, she said, do it. I was so surprised. But she knew. She taught writing, by the way, at the New School for Social Research and at Fairleigh Dickinson mm-hmm. University. And she knew what would sell, and she said, look, he's going to write about these wonderful child stars that everyone adores, Shirley Temple, who wouldn't want to read about her? And so I wrote it. I wrote the whole thing in the New York Public Library, and it took me about 6, 7, 8 months. It was wonderful going into that glorious building every day and sitting there writing and knowing that all the people around you were doing something similar.
Now, you must have been writing by hand.
Yes, doing the whole thing by hand. And then I was finished, and I went to a cocktail party. This was the year of the great cocktail party in New York. Everybody, when you went to visit someone, they would say, what will you have? That's the first question. In any event, I told Gertrude Buckman, a friend of mine who was at the party, I told her I'd written a book. And she said, oh, wonderful. And she said, what is it, The Child Stars and so on. She said, oh, good. Well, who's your agent? And I said, what? I had no idea that you now had to have an agent, you know. So she took me in hand and she said, I will send you a list tomorrow of agents, and then you can choose from 5 or 6 that I'll write down. And she gave me a list the next day, which was a Thursday. And the list said, number 1, go to so-and-so, and this was a big agent. And she said, he's very, very good, but he'd give you very little time. He's so well-known and so busy. And then she put down and another name was a girl, Lynn Nesbitt. And she said, Lynn is new. She's just starting. And for that reason, I think she'd really work for you. And then there were four others. And I just said to myself, I'll go with the up-and-coming person. That I called Lynn Nesbitt. This was on a Thursday. This is unbelievable. It's so wonderful.
You remember this. You remember what day of the week it was.
Right. And on Friday, she called up a friend of hers who was with McCann, Coward McCann Publishing, and she said, would you read this book by a new author, Norman Zerold, The Child Stars? He said, absolutely. He read it over the weekend. She called him on Monday morning, and he said, I want to publish it.
All right, now we've had authors on this show, some of whom took years to find their first publisher.
Oh, yeah.
The chicken soup people went through 140.
Really?
Yes. Before they found the company to publish.
I can't believe that.
They told them, oh, it's a stupid title. Nobody will read it. You know.
We've had authors who had a fairly easy route to publishing, but I don't think we've had anyone for whom it happened quite as serendipitously as this.
That's right.
It's so amazing. And the fact that it was written by someone from the Amana College who knew nothing about the subject at the time.
And the research that you did on this was just all in the library? You didn't actually interview people?
I interviewed a few people after doing all the research.
Okay.
But not as many as I did for later books, because in those early days of Hollywood books, many publishers said, oh, no, that's something for the magazine trade. You know, there were these
There were a lot of magazines. Yeah.
Big motion picture magazines.
Yeah. So they just wanted the facts.
Yeah.
And which you were able to get from, of course, nowadays research is a completely different game with the internet. Do you use the
internet? Yes, I do.
And
you can't do. It becomes like another hand, really, doesn't it?
Yes.
Another eye.
Yeah. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Norman Zerold, the author of That Reminds Me, a conversational memoir being released on Amazon January 12th. And Barnes & Noble as well. And will it be, and I imagine that it will be available at independent bookstores if they want to order it. That's always, we always like to support our local independent bookstore, so you can order things through there. And
did we get to the anecdote I was going to tell you about Barbara Walters?
Oh, yeah. You told us about, but you missed. Yeah, you skipped the. You didn't get to the part, the really interesting part.
Should I tell her?
Yes.
Yeah, that was. I found that very, very wonderful. It was New York at the time. NBC was going to interview me with the Today Show, Barbara Walters, and so when I arrived at that early hour, 5:30, she had a little time to talk to me and.
Now, you did tell us about the list. You told us that part.
The list of questions.
The list of questions.
Was there another
one?
But what you didn't tell us about was her
I know.
Yes.
So when Barbara and I started talking, I thought I noticed her leg pressing against mine under the table. Well, it was so early in the morning that I had to ask myself, am I seriously feeling this or... am I imagining it? Should I pull my leg away? Well, if I do and it's serious, then I'll get a rotten interview. But if but if it isn't serious and I continue, then I may get an even worse one, you know, if I'm mistaking the intention. And just when I was thinking that, Barbara said, do you feel my leg pressing against yours, Norman? I said, yes, Barbara, I do. And she said, when that happens, Norman, it means we're breaking for a commercial. You've got 10 seconds to finish your sentence. Got it? So that was a wonderful beginning, I thought. And afterwards she said, oh, I wish we'd had another segment that went so well. Oh. And she winged it, you know.
Absolutely. Now, that was for...
That was for the Charlie Ross... The Little Charlie Ross, yeah.
Did she interview you on any of your other books later on? Or?
Did she interview me? No. That was the only time I was on the Today Show.
Yeah.
Well, Monica mentioned this is a conversational memoir, and it is. When you read this, it's like... It's as if you're sitting here talking to Norman. I mean, it's just... For instance, he's going along, and then he says, I'm digressing for a moment. But why not? If the aside is interesting, it's okay, right? Thank you. I knew you'd understand. You're a peach.
That's very good you picked that out.
Yeah, that tickled me.
Now, before this book, when was the last book that you published? When would that have been?
Before, that reminds me, I think I published... two books in the 70s. I did a Sex Goddesses of the Silent Screen, mm-hmm. which is, by the way, it's a wonderful book. And in the book, I have a tremendous number of wonderful pictures of those old silent stars. I think that was one of the last ones that I published in that first barrage. And, oh, I had another one called The Skyscraper Doom, which was a science fantasy about all the skyscrapers in New York start melting from the top down.
Oh, wow.
And that was one of the last ones.
So that was the only long-form fiction that you published?
That's right.
But I understand you're a bit of a frustrated novelist at heart.
Well, I think I am. I did write a couple of novels, two or three or four or five. But But those never connected, and there was a reason in each case, I'm sure. But I always thought it would be marvelous fun to write fiction, like Somerset Maugham, who wrote a... The Razor's Edge and Of Human Bondage and wonderful books, and he wrote wonderful short stories. But I found that when I sat down at the typewriter, if I wrote nonfiction, well, I have my whole story right there. I just have to put it together in an entertaining, appealing way. But when you write fiction, you have to go right deep inside, and you have to be able to invent all those little things. It's a completely different thing, and I think there in that area, I think I was close. People would hold the copies that I sent them for a long time, but they never went for it except for that science fantasy book.
Interesting.
So I just stayed with the nonfiction.
And why did you stop publishing?
Oh, I didn't really.
Did you stop writing?
No, I kept writing this, that, and the other thing. But I didn't write any big things because, you know, the fun was gone, actually. It was not a novelty anymore. When you've done six or seven nonfiction books, some people can go on forever. They can just do one after another. But after I had done something, I realized how much research it would be to do another one. They wanted me to do one for the tough guys in films, Humphrey Bogart and Edward G. Robinson. Well, I thought not only will I... Garbo, I had one person to deal with, but here I'd have to do biographies of five or six or seven. It's an enormous amount of work to do that. It means you have to sit in a library for 6 months. And then I did have a technique. What I do is I would just write everything down. And then when I did, that would be the first thing, just to read everything that was available. Then I would go through my notes and I'd do the first version, which meant that I would go through all my notes and I would use a different color of pen or ink for each subject. For example, if it was Judy Garland, the childhood would all be in red. Whenever I got an article, all the things about childhood would be in red. So when I talked about her childhood and wrote it, all I had to do was read the red.
Oh.
And so on and so forth.
I wondered how you organized all that.
Yes, yeah. It's a lot of work, but it's quite easy. It's mechanical once you know that you're going to do that. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure other people do it in a different way, but...
Well, now with computers,
yeah,
it makes it much easier to sort and organize.
Yeah, while you're writing, absolutely.
Yeah. And the research, of course, you don't have to go to the library. You can do it all from your home,
mm-hmm.
or a lot of it.
Yeah. It's a new world completely.
Yeah. So are you tempted to take another stab, or are we going to get book two of your memoir?
and get the real story. Well, I might do, you know, I could really do a book twice as long as that.
Oh, I'm
my,
sure.
My autobiography. And that would be a different thing because I'd have to use different techniques again. I might do that. I thought of that. But what I'd like to do is... I'd like to write a book that kind of lifts people's spirit in some way. What is that book about that bird on the beach that, what are the birds?
Jonathan Livingston Seagull.
That's it. I would like to write a book like Jonathan Livingston Seagull, something that just makes your heart sing because it says something so beautiful.
Now, that book came out when I was probably a teenager or even younger, and I don't remember anything about it, except I do remember it was like a big thing.
Yeah, it was a big Richard thing.
Richard Buck. His daughter came to MUM. She was just graduated from there.
Really?
Oh. That is interesting. It's just unbelievable how many, I think Kurt Vonnegut's daughter came to Maharshi University didn't she come to get a degree, Ken?
You know what, Norman, I'm going to adjust your mic briefly because I think you're having to lean forward and I want you not to,
oh.
to lean quite so much.
Thank you.
Lift it a little bit.
Uh-huh.
There, is that better?
That's fine for me, yeah.
Because we had just moved here when MUM first came.
Mm.
And we met the first two gentlemen that were here kind of scouting things out, Jim Bellalove, and I don't remember the other gentleman's name.
Okay.
But, you know, yeah, so we've been here and through the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so Norman, are you going to tell us a little bit about, you know, we've talked somewhat about your writing life, although we've only brushed the surface.
Amazing. I can tell you some interesting stories.
I bet. But I would also like to give you an opportunity to tell a little bit about the other main track of your life.
Oh.
And how that brought you to Fairfield.
Oh, yes, that is very interesting because when I left in my very early years, I always thought of going to New York or abroad and so on and so forth. And I really
and you did.
Yeah, I did, but I didn't think I'd ever come back, to tell the truth, except on visits, you know. But in the meantime, Mother Nature did a fast one, and I came back for a reason. After I'd written all these books, I had a wonderful time in New York, but then I wanted to get away from that fast life in the city. And I went to California, land in this gorgeous little town of Laguna Beach. Have you ever been to California and Laguna Beach at all?
I haven't been to Laguna Beach, but I was born in California.
Oh, then you know of Laguna Beach.
Yeah.
It's really about as beautiful as you can get in this world. It's just got these little coves, you know, and the... Atlantic Ocean just rolling in, or the Pacific Ocean just rolling.
That'd be a good trick.
That's very good. So, I had just arrived when I saw a poster on a telephone pole, and it said, It showed a picture of Maharshi Mahesh Yogin. It said transcendental meditation. And I thought, meditation, well, that might be very good, because most spiritual groups have a meditation attached to them. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, and I was interested in the, here would be a yogi from the word go. Well, I got to this little room somewhere, which was very pleasant, in a private house, and there were about 15 people sitting around. And out came this young boy of 18 years old. And I thought, well, it's a very young yogi. And it wasn't the yogi, obviously. It wasn't Maharshi Mahesh Yogi. It was a young boy who was teaching transcendental meditation, as it, in small print, it said, as taught by Maharshi Mahesh Yogi. Well, the kid was really charming and delightful, and he looked so happy. And I thought, well, if it's good for him, why shouldn't it be good for me? It wasn't very expensive at the time. And so I signed up, and they said, of course, you'll have to go to the next lecture, which is also free. And I said, oh, and when is that? And they said, oh, well, we don't know when that is. This was in the beginning of the movement. But we'll call you. And I said, well, then you'll want my phone number, won't you? It went like that. And I didn't hear for weeks until this was the very beginning of the movement there. And one day I was walking, and someone called to me and said, you were at that introductory lecture, weren't you, the other day on meditation? And I said, yes. And they said, well, the preparatory lecture is going to be tomorrow. And I said, where? So I went to that. Wow. And I started. And for about, oh, 2 or 3 months, I did it, what I learned. I thought it was very pleasant. Nothing extraordinary, but I thought I always looked forward to doing it. And then the friend at whose house I had learned the actual technique again stopped me on the street and said, I'm going to go to a weekend meditation course. Do you want to go? And I said, well, I have nothing. You know, I was new in Laguna Beach, so I had nothing to do. And I said, yes. And I went to this weekend course at a monastery, by the way. Mm-hmm. And it was so delightful, and I felt something deeper happening. You know, we would meditate in a group for 3 or 4 days, and that did something, and the whole thing finally took hold. And the next day, I began a year of just feeling ecstatic every single day when I got up. I was just so happy. I just didn't want the day to end or... Every day. Wow. It was just glorious. After that, it seemed to kind of quiet down a little. It didn't change, but I was so used to it that... So that's...
So for you, TM really changed your life.
It changed my life. And then when I heard that this university was starting here, and all the people that I knew in Laguna Beach who were practicing transcendental meditation, they were all moving to Fairfield. So I was losing all my friends, so I came too.
And then you left.
And then I left, and then
and
I
then
came,
you came back.
Back.
And then you left, yep. And then you came back.
That's right.
We call that the rubber band effect.
Yeah, that's very good. I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We taught TM in Cedar Falls.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh, and you became a TM teacher.
I became a TM teacher. And after that, by the way, when during that ecstatic period, this is interesting, I really wanted to share it with everyone I knew. So I wrote everybody that I'd ever heard of that I hadn't had address for and sent them a newspaper clipping or something and said, you ought to try this. And I'm sure people, you know, that hadn't heard from me for years were quite surprised. And but I just felt like doing it. And I thought to myself, you know, if someone gave me $1 million and said, there's one condition, you won't be able to meditate anymore, would you do it? Someone asked me that one day, because I was so enthusiastic about it.
Yeah.
And I said, I would not take $1 million.
Wow.
I would absolutely not give up this part of my life. No.
Wow.
It's just such a refreshing good
thing.
Well,
Norman, we only have about 1 minute left.
Mm-hmm.
And I did want to mention you also, you talk quite a bit in your book about a couple of, or at least one book project that you didn't get any credit for. Your name wasn't on the cover, but you helped
Anthony Quinn.
Anthony Quinn write his biography.
Mm. Yes.
And that was seems like a fascinating.
That was an adventure, let me tell you. He's bigger than life.
Yeah. And maybe we can have you back on again. I would love to have you back, come back and talk some more about the difference between, you know, writing a biography, then helping somebody
write their
own autobiography.
Yes.
Your experience as an editor in the magazine, how that, you know, played into your career as a writer, and then how the whole memoir genre is different and
that would be fine. I think there are lots of very interesting
things to say.
So thank you so much for being here with us, and thank you, Ken, for getting in touch with us to bring Norman and for helping him have this book see the light of day.
It's taken 5-6 years.
That's nice.
And Caroline, you have a quote.
I have a quote
to end with the day.
I don't always quote from the book, but this time I'm going to. And Norman says, "How little we know what's going on in those around us. If we did, how much more understanding and accepting we would probably be."
Oh, I like that.
How true.
Thank you for saying, quoting that.
And if you missed part of this interview, it'll be up on the KRUUFM.com archives and also writersvoices.com. You can check it out there. Or you can listen again on Monday morning at 8 a.m. if you're listening to us on Friday. Go to Amazon and see all of Norman's books are available there, and I believe some of them may end up coming back into print as a result of this.
In fact, The Moguls is going to its third printing.
The Moguls is going into its third printing. Congratulations,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Norman.
Thank you so much.
It came out in 91.
And stay tuned now for Planet Erstwhile with our own James Moore.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writer's Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.